Good morning, and you're very welcome to Countrywide. Between now and nine, how Australia successfully got rid of bovine TB. On Fourth Mountain, patience pays off. 6 years of careful restoration brings a Wexford cottage back to life. And a poem to remember Manchon McGann.
This was the dairy, circulates around. And then this is the milking, parlour.
When was your last milking?
I wouldn't have milked now since last October, a year ago now.
Well, that's Cavan farmer Fintan Cooney. You might remember him. He joined us last week to talk about volunteering for the civil defence. But when I visited his farm, he also told me about the devastating loss of his entire dairy herd to tuberculosis last year. Fintan's story is, of course, all too familiar for farmers across the country as TB incidence hits a 15-year high. Well, the Department of Agriculture has worked to eradicate TB in cattle since the 1950s, spending an eye-watering 5.5 billion, yes, billion euro in public money along the way. And now the problem has reached a threshold where it may also threaten international trade. And yet it persists. Badgers are culled, infected cows are sent to the factory, and farmers, like you heard there, like Fintan, are left with empty sheds, still no closer to understanding why their herds became infected. But scientists are clear about what's driving these breakdowns. Last year, Simon Moore, Professor of Veterinary Epidemiology in UCD, spoke to Philip about his research, which has identified four sources of infection. And the biggest of them was not the badger, but other cows.
Really, there's four different sources that are important. Three of them relate to cattle, and one relates to wildlife. And in terms of cattle, the first one is what we would call hidden or residual infection. That is infection in animals that don't test positive. So the second one is the movement of cattle. And basically, it's a little bit the same. It's really cattle, again, with hidden infection. So people don't realize these animals are infected, but it's cattle moving from farm to farm and taking infection with them. The third one is when the bacteria that causes TB can be disseminated from infected cattle into the environment. And these bacteria can survive for a period of time and provide a further source of infection. And then the final source of infection is from wildlife. In Ireland, that's primarily badgers, although certainly in County Wicklow, deer are also involved. The contribution of these four sources is roughly similar. So about 15% roughly due to hidden infection, 15% due to moved cattle, 15% due to the environment, and 15% directly due to badgers, with the remaining 40%, essentially there's more than a single infection source and it's not possible to disentangle which is responsible.
Simon Moore from UCD speaking to Philip last year. Well, last month, the government allocated 157 million euro of public money in budget 2026 to the Department of Agriculture to continue their efforts to eradicate the disease. Cavan is a TB hotspot. Well, pedigree breeder Patrick Gaynor, who's from the county, was forced to cull his valuable herd last year, which put an end to his dairy farm. During the week, I visited him in Mulla.
Ah, sure, look at the extent that we got it in would leave questions. You know, I don't know how we got it so bad that it brought everything in a matter of 2 to 3 years. You know, it was badgers caught. We caught some badgers and the department tested them, and I don't think any of them had TB that they caught around. We have no deer. As I said, we have a closed herd. Sometimes we'd buy maybe a few baby calves, that's all, baby heifer calves, that's all we ever bought.
So could they have brought it?
They couldn't have brought it because they were from a clear herd and they never had TB, the people we bought, because we always bought them off the same person all the time, a few of them. So it's just baffling how it got so. Now, a few neighbours had maybe ones and twos and threes down just enough once, and that'd be cleared up again and away again. But
and is it possible just, that cows in nearby fields can infect each other?
It goes through the nose, the breeding end of it. I don't think they could either, because they'd have to be with them a long time. Yeah. You know, they wouldn't be with them long enough to. I think they'd have to be nearly a half an hour with their noses together before they can breed it across.
That happen?
No, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened. It's just baffling. It's baffling how and even the department now just couldn't handle on it. They couldn't understand it. I thought it might be in the sheds. I thought it might be one cow that wasn't showing it up, which we had some cows when they did go, didn't show up in the blood, didn't show up in the skin, and they had it when we went to the factory. But then on the other hand, there was cows that showed up in the blood at home and showed up in the skin, and they hadn't it when they went into the factory. So there's no accurate test until the animal is dead, and that is to see the lungs and that.
And your story really started back around COVID, around 2020.
Around 20, just as COVID was ending, we had a couple of animals went with it, and they just started creeping up bit by bit, worse and getting worse, and had a couple of clear, maybe one clear test, two clear tests, and then back down again, three or four. So I'd say in 23, they decided, or maybe end of 22, they decided that they would bring them all, that there was no other way out of it.
So from 2020 onwards, there were a couple of cows in your herd that had it, but then things got a lot worse by 2023.
A lot worse. There'd be 15 going down, and there'd be maybe 20 going down the next time, and the department decided that we'd chat about it, and decided that the only way was to bring them all.
Bringing them where?
Bringing them to the factory, slaughtering them. During that time, some cows would go down, some heifers would go down that was in calf, but they wouldn't bring them if they were within 21 days of calf, and they couldn't bring them to the factory, seemingly. And they'd leave them until they'd calve, and then about a fortnight after they'd calve, they'd bring both and slaughter them. The calf had to be slaughtered, and the cow had to be brought to the factory.
So, on your farm that happened, did it?
Yeah, the cows had to be slaughtered on the farm. They didn't go, they just were slaughtered and brought to the knackery. So that was tough now to see that happening.
So you had to allow the heifers to give birth.
Yeah.
You knew all the time that the mother was going to die, the calf was going to die.
Yeah. And look, you would get up in the middle of the night and you'd make sure that they got beastings and you'd make sure that they were fed right for the fortnight. It was tough just to know that they weren't going to be there all the time, you know, but you'd still keep them happy anyhow, you know. Suppose maybe when you went back to bed, you'd say, look at a lovely calf, but what's the point of a lovely calf when he's going to go? You know, the last cows went, I'd say, in March of 24, and there was 25 baby calves. Now, they were only about a fortnight old, 3 weeks old, and they all had to be slaughtered in the yard and brought to the kennels. The kennels brought them. So that was tough. That was tough now to see them going like that, you know. The yard was quiet then for a while. Well, you'd go up in the mornings and nothing to do, you know. Just hoping. We were into showing at that stage as well, and that stopped. That had to stop, sure. And that was tough enough as well, you know, because show was a big part of our life.
Of course.
Yeah, we were into showing in a big way.
So by 2024, empty sheds, you weren't milking anymore.
Milking
your
nothing.
Animals were gone.
Gone, yeah.
And then I presume it's a waiting game?
Waiting game. We had to wait six months, I think. 6 months before we could buy in anything again. So we had to wash out all the sheds thoroughly and disinfect them and things like that. And
at that time, did the Department of Agriculture or anyone say to you, look, we think this is how your herd got TB?
We were feeding the cows along the manger. It wasn't a manger, it was just a flat concrete. They thought maybe the badgers was coming in and lying on the silage. It was one tort, and one tort that was in the sheds. And they were baffled as much as myself over it, you know.
Because the badgers that have been caught in this area were negative.
Were negative.
Yeah.
So it didn't make sense. It didn't add up at all, you know. The end of 24, yeah, we bought in calves, Angus calves. Because you just couldn't afford to go back into cows at that stage because the
into dairying.
Into
yeah.
dairy, and you know, because cows was very expensive. Come on. Shh. Come on. Come on, girls. Come on. Shh. Come on, girls. Come on. Come on. Go on, go on, that's it, go on. Go on, keep going. Go on.
And the decision to go back in and bring animals on your land, I mean, does it come with a certain amount of nervousness?
Yeah, it was anxious. Now, we have one clear test got. We're tested every 6 months now.
Okay.
Every 6 months. It's a nervous time, it's a nervous time, it's a nervous time for testing. But I think it's a nervous time for all farmers testing at the moment because it's just so big of a thing now, the TB. And every farmer is feared, no matter where you are in the country, you know, of this TB. So you just wonder about it. It just baffles me, you know.
Yeah. But and now there's been 80 million or so extra from the budget.
Yeah.
Public money.
Public money. It hasn't worked up until now, but I think the minister has brought a 30-day test, I think, is coming in for movement. And I think it needs to come in, that 30-day test, because at the moment, we say an animal can go around the country for 12 months on the one test, and if they had TB, how many animals are they after affecting, you know, and things like that. So it'll just it's just costing them the a fortune, the country a fortune of money, like.
And we're in Cavan where the reactor percentages are higher than the average around the country. You must know a lot of farmers who've gone down with TB. How are they managing it from a mental health perspective?
My case, we had a good family and everyone was close and we coped with ourselves, you know. But there is farmers out there that's on their own, a lot of bachelor farmers, I suppose, that has no one living with them. It would be tough on them if all their cows went down, you know. And I think if there could be a support line that you could just ring up and have a chat about it and ring up someone that was after going through it themselves, and, you know, it would help a lot that way in the mental health end of it, you know.
We're standing in your field surrounded by your new animals. What is the future for you here, Patrick? Are you going to go back dairying?
I don't think we can afford to go back at the moment. And I'm not going to start all over again. I started when I was 16, so I've enough done. That's all you can do, and that's it.
Patrick Gaynor there in Cavan, and you can really hear just how baffled he is, and I'm sure farmers listening will relate to that. And not even the Department of Agriculture could tell him with certainty the source of infection in his animals. It's a very, very difficult picture indeed. Well, we've been trying for 70 years to rid Ireland of bovine TB, and that goal might feel like a very distant goal, but it is far from impossible. Other countries have done it. Australia, for example, was officially declared TB-free back in 1997. So how did they do it? Well, Dr. Ron Glanville is a vet who held senior state roles and was one of the experts behind their eradication programme. So I spoke to him and asked him whether, despite differences between Australian and Irish farming systems, there are lessons we can learn from their success.
Oh, definitely, Ella. I mean, there are parts of Australia that are quite similar to Ireland when we go to the south, and we were able to eradicate TB from the southern parts reasonably quickly. But we don't have the badger and deer issues that you have in Ireland, but there are certainly some key aspects of our program that we ran here from 1970 that I think lessons can be learned from. We took a fairly strict and tough approach in Australia. The industry, the cattle industry in Australia, paid for about approximately 50% of the program. Our very last case of TB was detected in the year 2000, and it was that last herd was eradicated over the next couple of years. So the early 2000s was the last time we detected TB in Australia. But I think we showed in Australia that you can still eradicate the disease in dairy herds in reasonably intensive conditions, provided you apply strict controls.
Ron, let's start with the cattle controls and the risk-based approach. It seems that one of the turning points in Australia's success was deciding to really get tough on the disease, to take a zero-tolerance approach, even if in the short term it meant farmers and the industry lost out, a kind of short-term pain, long-term gain view. Can you talk a little bit about this approach and what was done?
A key thing was movement of animals. So the most likely way a farm is going to get TB is to acquire animals from a TB-infected, another TB-infected farm. So all our movement controls were based on herd statuses. So you couldn't move cattle to another breeding farm, for example, unless they came from a free herd. We didn't really rely on individual tests of animals for movement testing. We based that more on the status of the herd. The standard tuberculin test hasn't got a very good sensitivity in under Australian conditions, probably only around 70%. Firstly, we read them hard, so we encourage veterinarians to identify any animal that showed any slightest reaction to the TB test, and they were all taken out. They were destroyed and post-mortemed. But also we applied this to the individual groups of animals. So when it came to eradicating the disease, we applied the test as a group test, not an individual test. So we tried to identify groups of animals. The approach, particularly towards the end of the program, was to depopulate that group.
And when you say depopulate, you mean cull. I mean, they were sent to the factory.
That's right. They were sent to the abattoir. That's correct.
In Ireland, the Department of Agriculture over the decades has decided how to spend billions of euro of public money trying to eradicate TB in cattle here, and it clearly hasn't worked. I mean, things are only getting worse. In Australia, you moved from a fully government-run programme to one where industry and farmers shared responsibility and the costs. Can you explain what you did and what difference that shift made?
Yes, well, that made a big difference because the farming community had skin in the game, and they were part of the management of the program. And to tell you the truth, actually, often the industry representatives were tougher than the government representatives because they were paying for the scheme. They wanted it to be over and done with as quickly as possible. So they were quite tough in terms of the sorts of controls they expected. It had a really positive effect in terms of making sure the program progressed. There was a big meeting between government and industry in 1984. Industry weren't particularly happy with the way the program was progressing at that time, so there was a decision made that they would pay for 50% of the program from then on. That was paid for through a slaughter levy. Half of the program was paid by industry, and because they were paying, they wanted it sped up. And so from 1984 right through to 1989, we essentially eradicated most of the TB.
You had a quick look at the new plan from Ireland's Department of Agriculture that was published in September, these 30 actions in total, backed by an extra and additional 85 million euro in funding. Taken together, from the quick look that you've had, Ron, do you believe these measures will finally work? Do you think they'll be enough to turn things around?
Well, there are some good things in that program. I think the wildlife controls, what they're doing there is good. Some of the new technology, exploring new technologies such as using the gamma interferon tests and looking at new vaccines is good. But the program in Ireland is still fairly gentle in terms of trying to minimise the immediate impact on farmers. So it's hard to have a crystal ball, but the way I'm seeing it is that the current program in Ireland, I doubt that you would get to final eradication through that method. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One of the key things, I think, looking at the Irish program is that it's still too easy to move animals around and spread the disease. And from what I've read, there are still significant numbers of new cases, new herds being detected every year. So, and the other one is just cleaning up herds that are infected. So a tougher line approach might be needed there.
That's interesting, Ron. You use the word, it's too gentle still. Can you just explain exactly what you mean? And when you look at that plan, what the key things you would do differently in it?
You really have to be tough in terms of the way you apply the test, so that you seek out and detect all the infected herds, and then once you've got the infected herds pinpointed, that you implement strict controls and strict control measures, eradication methods to get rid of the infection in those herds. One thing I've learned during my long career in animal health is that often it's the last bit of infection that is the hardest to get. You really need to take a very hardline approach to finally eradicate a disease. It can be fairly easy to get the disease down to, you know, reasonably low levels, but to really get that last bit of infection, find all the infected herds, you really need to take a hardline approach.
Some really interesting points there from Dr. Ron Glanville in on what Ireland can learn from Australia's success in eradicating TB. And my thanks also to Patrick Gaynor and Fintan Cooney for sharing their stories. 51551 for your texts, countrywide at rte.ie for your emails. We are talking land prices after these.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
With the pressure these days to build homes as quickly as possible, it's not often you find a group of people who celebrate the fact that their house project is taking years. But up on Forth Mountain, which is just south of Wexford town, a group of volunteers and craftspeople led by Pauline Shannon have been doing exactly that. Since 2019, they've been slowly and carefully restoring an old cottage. And after 6 years of work, there's finally been a milestone moment. The roof is now complete. Well, our reporter Della Kilroy went to meet the team as they put the finishing touches on their home.
Pauline, she's the boss lady.
Pauline, you're wanted.
Well, we're on Forth Mountain, which is the highest point in South Wexford, even though it's not really a mountain, it's just a hill really, but everywhere around it is very, very flat. So there are huge views right out to the Salty Islands, down to Hookhead, and you can see back up to the Black Stairs at the north end of Wexford. We're standing at what was Furlong's Cottage on Forth Mountain. Forth Mountain was an area of very poor land in Wexford and nobody really wanted it, so it was commonage. And what happened generally was that a second son in a family from a farm would come up here, build a little house, take some land, reclaim it basically from the mountain and make a little farm which was self-sufficient for themselves.
I'm on Forth Mountain, where for the past 6 years, local volunteers have been busy restoring an old homestead, deserted in the 1950s.
There was a guy called Jim Furlong lived here, and it was basically on a crossroads of paths across the mountain. He played the fiddle, so it was quite a music house. Carmel actually would know quite a bit more about the history. Carmel.
Jim Furlong was last. Furlongs were the last family to live here and vacated a cottage in the 1950s. And, you know, things had become, people had moved off the mountain at that stage, and the state had bought the land. Cuilche developed the forestries. It was a very different scene 100 years ago to what it is now. Like, little roads crisscrossed the mountain everywhere, and there were dozens of houses like this. So really what we're doing here is recreating a sample using all the traditional methods of building.
I call it the men's shed, the men and women's shed up here in the mountain. But there's a great social aspect to it, you know, great dedication also.
Conversations about everything, anything, even the benefits of net curtains. And someone said the place rings with laughter every day we're here. And it really does, doesn't it, Karma?
And what keeps the whole thing together really is the social aspect as well as the reconstruction.
You're going to show me around now. We're going to walk in. So maybe
absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Tell yeah. Me. It's a small little cottage, two windows and a front door with another room, which we think was an animal shed. And we built back in here, built up the walls again with stone and mud, then used lime mortar for sealing the walls.
And you can hear people working away. What's going on here today?
That's right. Today we're plastering the chimney. Our stonemason, Pat Hickey, is with us. We also have some bits and pieces here which we found when we were digging out.
So we have a kettle.
A pot. rim of a wheel. We have lots of glass bottles, an old hobnail boot that we found.
A really old looking boot.
Isn't it?
You can see the sole is fully
worn. These things were dug up when we were actually excavating to find the footprint of the cottage.
Some have described it as a Cayley house.
It has been described as a Cayley house, and I think that was in latter years. It was a Cayley house. Jim played a bit of music and they went away again. He also taught music, so it was a Cayley house as well, even though it was so tiny. You can't imagine it being a Cayley house, but apparently it was the centre of life for the mountain.
You're going to introduce me maybe to a few more people?
Absolutely. Pat can shout from the roof, but I'm not sure you'll pick him up.
Okay, Pat, how you fix your nails there?
Yeah, I can do another three or four.
Okay, we'll try this trick.
Yeah. Pat is our stonemason and absolute integral part of the group.
We're looking at a picture of it from 2019, before the work was done.
So really, there was just some stone above the ground. You could walk by and say there's nothing there. Everything growing up in the middle of it, on top of it, around it, it was barely visible. You're here today, the roof is on. So that's great. It's my first time seeing the roof on. It's got a life of its own. It looks like you could live in it now. I'm going to make some lime wash with you later on. You'll be able to see how traditional lime wash was made.
So it's normally a combination of lime, sand and a bit of gravel in certain proportions. It looks like baking a cake. There's a bit of chemistry involved.
It's been a labour of love for the community. With the help of council grants and weekly meetings, they want to showcase life as it once was on the mountain.
I got involved when I retired. I was working in the vocational school in town, or what used to call the techs. So at that stage, my wife was wondering, what the hell am I going to do with you sitting around at home all day watching snooker on the telly?
It was the early part of it really was just building up the walls, literally from nothing, really. A lot of the skill was just to find a stone that would fit the gap. And I remember one day I watched him, he says, is there any greater pleasure than seeing the stone that matches the gap that you're looking for, you know? And I could see what he was talking about. You know, if it never gets finished, I'm just happy to be involved. There's always something to be done here.
Local carpenter John made the traditional windows and doors for the cottage. He has memories of life on the mountain going back to the 1960s.
It was very desolate and very quiet up here, do you know what I mean? Because there was no forestry roads right now, it was just forestry. It would have been a hard life, because even if you look out around, you know, you see the marks of the old little fields. They grew their own few potatoes and vegetables. And you can see inside there the wheel of a cart. And should have been, I suppose, a pig or two and a cow. That's, you know what I mean, that's about it, the basics.
What's it meant for you personally to be involved?
I like, you know, the way the old things were made and where they put the effort into it. You know, there was no shortcuts, there was no nail guns, there was no compressors. If it had to be done, it had to be done the hard way. And was genuine craftsmen, you know what I mean, where now it's the quickest way in, the quickest way out. There was no such thing as draft proof and then weather strips and all that. It was just the bare necessities.
And there was music in this
more
house.
More than idle, yes. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Well, at that time there was no television, no radio. And so you made your own music, do you know what I mean? And it was like go from house to house, they used to go and play cards and things like that.
What would it mean to you to have some music and life back in here?
Oh, it'd be brilliant, do you know. It'd create a complete new, different atmosphere, do you know what I mean? It brings new life to the area as well, do you know?
The roof went on the other week, the doors and the windows are going on soon. What would you like to see here?
Well, we might have the odd event here, the odd local event maybe, and the storytelling.
Get the fire going. I think it's essential we get the fireplace going.
And there's a great revival in music groups around, not just the county, but because of the Fla and that kind of stuff. Just involving people in some historical references to that music. So it's a great memory for people to have as well, you know.
Della Kilroy there reporting from Furlong's homestead on Wexford's Fourth Mountain, and best of luck to them with their project. text here, 51551. Ella, that was a very good piece on TB. Many thanks. Did you seek a response from the Department of Agriculture here? They've spent an awful lot of money for actions to be still described as gentle, says Mairead in Galway. Well, we will hope to speak to the Minister for Agriculture, Martin Hayden, at some stage over the next few weeks. Thank you very much, Mairead, for your text. Now, I don't own any farm. I don't own a farm, rather, or any land, but I love chatting about land prices. Two large farms have just come on the market, and the difference in their asking prices tells us an awful lot about how we value land today. The first is in Connemara, a 685-acre farm. It is listed at €950,000, which works out at just under £1,400 an acre. The second is an 805-acre farm attached to Rockwell Cottage in Tipperary that the Spiriton Order has been forced to sell. And it has an asking price of €21 million. That's just over €26,000 an acre. Two farms, both in Ireland, both sizable, yet their price tags could not be more different. So what does it say about land prices today? Well, with me this morning are Michael Brady, land agent and managing director of the Brady Group, Liam Hennessy, nature financing lead with Hometree, and Ronan Power, interim CEO of Solar Ireland. Good morning to you all. Michael, I might start with you. You've no involvement in either of these two sales, but looking at Rockwell Farm at 26,000 an acre, when the average price of good quality land is half that, you've identified five potential types of buyers who might have a spare 21 million in their pocket. Can we start at the top with the trophy investor?
Okay. Good morning, Ella. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, look, it's a phenomenal amount of money. This is probably the biggest dairy farm that has come for sale in Ireland, in my career, certainly. And yes, look, who's going to buy it? Top of the pile has to be the high net worth individuals. We've recently seen the game played out in the courts in the Barron Estate. Those two individuals will certainly be in Tipperary looking for this land. And there are others. There are individuals who have sold businesses for literally billions in this country. And land is, we have an innate, I suppose, relationship with property and land in this country. And there's an emotional side comes into it. I call it the H factor, the human factor. And that's going to be at play here. So number one, high net worth individuals. There's number two, we call them tax investors. There are tax benefits for transferring assets from one generation to the next. That'll be at play here as well. And then number three, you have the various land investors who are people who just have some money, want to invest in land and take a long-term view. Number four, unfortunately, the farmer is a long ways down the list when it comes to the trophy farm in Rockwell. But farmers are still the main purchasers of land. There could possibly be a syndicate of farmers come together to buy this. And finally, you have a certain amount of private equity coming in. We have private equity coming into every other business sector, maybe in the economy, not so much in farming, except forestry. Private equity is effectively pension funds or huge investment funds who decide to invest in the country. So there are your five categories, Ella.
And you can't, I mean, we can't possibly talk about Rockwell without asking about, as you mentioned, the Barn Estate case. You have John Magner. I mean, what do you think are the chances that this land will end up with Coolmore horses instead of dairy cows on it? I mean, is it priced for him, basically?
Yes, that's well, exactly. That's it. Or for others. Others, there are more than them. That's a strong possibility. It's in the area of Coolmore. They bought a dairy farm last year, Kilree, up in County Kilkenny. They bought that one as well. So it could stay in Dairing. It would be a shame, in my opinion, for it to come out of Dairing. There's been a Rotary Parlour put in there recently. The only thing I would say about Rockwell that maybe might lend it towards a farmer syndicate is that there's no period house in Rockwell for sale with the farm. It's Rockwell Farms for sale. It's not the old Rockwell College School, which I understand is still continuing. So that might just take it down a peg, you know,
and it is possible price tag to split even
the farm
more,
up because it is split by the old Cork Dublin Road. So it'll be interesting to see, but I agree, it is priced for that. When you look at the return on investment at 25,000-26,000 an acre, it's phenomenal. I've done a few figures on it there, Ellen. Like 21 million is the asking price for the land. But by the time you'd be in there milking cows, you'd have over 25 million spent. Like a phenomenal
you'd
figure
want to be
is that the
gold,
stamp duty alone on that would be nearly 1.6 million.
Liam
you'd
Hennessy.
Buy a farm for 1.6 million.
Indeed. Liam Hennessy, talk to me about the Uachtaráid farm. What kind of buyer would be looking at that? Would it just be a kind of traditional farmer type or not?
That's a very good question.
Liam.
Good morning, Ella. Thanks for having me on as well. So when we look at the Uachtaráid farm, I suppose we have to look at the landscape of the buyers maybe out the west. If we're looking at regular farmers out the west of Ireland, we can see a lot of income insecurity arising from the farm systems that exist there. So I envision demand for a farm that size off local purchasers. The demand might be quite high, but capacity to buy that land or actually even source funding might be quite low, you know. Chances are that that property, whether it's an existing farmer or an outside farmer, to buy that property will be using not non-farming income sources or non-farming assets, as well as, you know, the Rockwell farm, you know. So it's a bit of a challenge. While the purchaser might...
What kind of buyer would be in the market for it? I mean, anyone who's keeping an eye on the likes of carbon and nature credits and that kind of financing might begin to look ahead in the next couple of years, and 1,400 an acre as it's priced at the moment might look like very good value.
Absolutely. And we are seeing that, I suppose. We can see it ourselves in Hometree with maybe people around or in our kind of environment. You are seeing a lot of speculative buyers enter into the marketplace for sites like Uachtaráid. There's a nice property on that. People might think it'd be a nice holiday home with their own private parkland. We are seeing speculative buyers, and that's arising really because of the lack of insecurity or the lack of sentiment towards existing environmental programs within the Irish state. So any potential purchaser of that site is speculative, and as a result, maybe for the more conventional buyer, it might just be a bit rich for people's taste at the moment. There's no line of sight maybe to those existing income streams you're talking about, whether it's nature or it's carbon or it's biodiversity. So at this present point in time, it's highly speculative, which unfortunately leads to maybe a lot of outside or remote interest that could harm the local environment and economy and community as much as help it.
It's not just private money, though, is it? There's also public money looking ahead, I suppose, particularly the Nature Restoration Law, the chance that there may be the likes of the Upland Native Woodland Scheme coming on. Again, between the potential of private money coming in, nature financing, and public money funding more nature-based restoration, that kind of parcel of land could look quite attractive.
Absolutely, and I guess that's specifically where Hometree are trying to position ourselves, in that we're trying to take ideally privately owned land held by local landowners and farmers, and combining that with access to, you know, public sources of funding to help the Irish government and the Irish people achieve this nature restoration law. I suppose the term aggregator is what's being coined out there, where we're a service provider for nature restoration in these areas, while maybe not trying to displace the existing cultures or the people that live there. You know, I know there's a lot of, I suppose, community resistance or political resistance to the estate going in and acquiring land. We see that recently with pushback on the MPWS acquiring sites. I see a space for that ideally, but, you know, we also want to appreciate the people that exist in those communities and maybe their spirit. If there's local buyers or there's, we'd say, local interest for those sites, I don't see why we can't do that, why we can't affect nature restoration in partnership with the people too, you know.
Ronan Power, good morning. Solar industry, I mean, in terms of the land being used in new ways, your industry is changing the landscape in a very visual way. Within 15 years, you want to target 68,000 acres. I mean, that's a huge, vast quantity of land. Where is it going to go?
It'll mostly go where the demand is required, right? We're seeing a huge increase in demand for electricity in Ireland, aligned to our national electrification strategy and our climate action targets. So at the moment, the deployment is heavy in Meath, Wexford, anywhere where there's good sunlight and available land and demand and the ability to connect the assets to the grid.
So you need more than anything else to connect to the grid. You need that kind of infrastructure. So the Uachtaráid farm out in Mayo it's no huge interest to you at the moment?
Well, not necessarily. I don't know if any of the developers have been looking at it, but it's not to say that it wouldn't be of interest, but there would be a huge amount of studies that have to go into that land before you'd be able to decide if it's capable of taking on a solar installation or not.
Do you want to buy land?
No, mostly we would look at leasing land in this industry and create kind of like parallel revenue streams for farmers. I think it's probably overlooked quite a bit where you're moving into what could be a 40-year lease for a farmer. Over that term, it gives fixed incomes to the farmers, which they can actually borrow against. You know, so if they're looking to innovate in their own ways or invest into their own machinery or optimize their operations, they can actually use those future cash flows to borrow against.
21 million for 800 acres. Would solar give any return on that?
It would be a challenge. It would have to be said. I think it would be a challenge to get a return on 21 million for the farm, no matter what you're doing. I think you mentioned farming gold. I think it's probably a good place to start.
I suppose whether you're farming vegetables, tillage, livestock or solar, it is in essence all about farming energy. But how do you respond to criticism that food producing land is being lost to solar farms? Because there are farmers anecdotally who will say these solar industry people are coming along and they're pushing prices way beyond what farmers can afford.
I don't think it's fair necessarily to say that, right? There's a use of land for everything, okay? So we're looking at, you know, 10% of the land in Ireland is currently used for sheep farming, as an example, of grasslands. Sheep farming and solar farms can actually coexist. So you can actually sheep farm in the same land as you're doing there. Anecdotally, golf courses will use about twice the amount of land than we'll actually use to hit our 8 gigawatt climate action target of 2030. I'm a massive golf fan, so I'm not saying that we shouldn't be golfing. But what I mean is that we're probably looking at things with today's eyes rather than thinking to ourselves, what's this investment mean? But also, I think if you look at the way farming is, it's alternative revenue streams for farmers, right? It's their land. They've obviously made a decision to go down this route to secure long-term income for their farm and help to support their operations.
Liam, can I ask about rewilding? I mean, there are a number of big investors who have a lot of spare cash. They're prepared with a big parcel of land like the one in Uachtaráid to put money into it. I mean, are they also putting farmers out of business over there and pushing land prices up?
Yeah, it's a challenge with regards to, we'd say, those high ticket investors, as Michael would describe them. I guess, you know, I'd always ask what you classify as a farmer. If you're talking about an existing group of people in an area, they're farmers. But, you know, a lot of people aspire to, you said at the outset that you don't own land. A lot of people aspire to own land and be farmers. And we talk about new entrants quite a bit. You know, I don't see where we can start deciding who gets to be a farmer and who doesn't. You spoke about farming for energy there. You know, we can farm for nature. We can class nature as an output as well. You know, where that comes into energy, you know, farming upland or farming lowland extensively for nature, you'll also have a food output, but you'll also have a nature output, whether that's from potentially high net worth individuals or people who have been there all along. I don't know. When we need to get nature into our local environment so desperately, I don't see how we can sit in judgment as to who we should allow to do it, you know.
But with the focus on nature restoration, do you think this term marginal land, which has been used so much for land west of the Shannon, that really that's a thing of the past, that the land there, for example, in Uachtaráid, could generate a lot of value if the potential is seized by whoever might buy it?
I agree with you 100%, Ella. The term marginal, in my mind, is subjective. We're just deciding on the value of the potential outcome of it. You know, that farm in Uachtaráid, in my mind, from the lens of the organisation I'm working with, is a potentially a high output property, you know.
Michael, just going back to you, John Magner's rival for the Barn estate, Maurice Regan, the building tycoon, has said that he won't bid against any dairy farmer, but he has declared an interest in buying Rockwell Farm, perhaps in some sort of partnership with local farmers. Do you think that's likely?
It's pure marketing, Ella. Pure marketing, in my opinion. I think, yeah, well, he could buy it and lease it back out to the farmers. There is a possibility of a partnership as well. But at the end of the day, if Mr. Regan decides to buy this, he's buying it for himself first. You know, he will decide what land use he will do after. He could put horses on it himself. He could run his own dairy farm there. He'd go into partnership with a farmer. In my opinion, I think that's a marketing comment, and it was put out there for the media.
Okay. And I lapped it up, Michael. I lapped it up.
3-acre farm if you want to buy a farm. You mentioned you're in the market for land.
I have a spare 21 million in my pocket. Of course I do. Thank you very much. Michael Brady, Land Agent and Managing Director of the Brady Group. Liam Hennessy, Nature Financing Lead with Hometree. And Ronan Power, who joined me from Interim CEO from Solar Ireland, will keep a close eye on what happens to those two land parcels. Well, it's been a month since Manchon McGann died, and at lunchtime today, his ashes will be scattered on the hill of Uisneach in a public ceremony to celebrate his life and connection to the land, nature and the Irish language. Manchon's absence is one that is keenly felt by so many people. So to end this morning, a poem by our regular contributor, Janet Heron.
I don't have the right words for an Irish autumn. You would have unfuckled D-ruck for the lemon colour of elm leaves that flow like a tide on the boreen, or the shape of amber ferns cascading down a ditch, or the red colour that mottles blackberry bushes, or the soft crunch of damp branches underfoot, or the intense brightness of a grey wash morning sky, or the swish toss of a squirrel's tail as it scurries up a Scots pine, or the cocky stare of a teenage fox stopping in the road. Then I remember Ira Rua, Madra Rua, Rua. This word is a vanishing spell I will plant like an acorn on the tongues of my children.
Beautiful there from Janet Heron remembering Manchon McGann. Well, that's it for this week. Amandine Passett Devine was our BCO. On sound is Tom Norton. Playback is on the way. Have a great weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.